Vår Herre Jesus red over en bro. Der møtte han om en ond kvinne. Hvort skal du, sagte jeg Kristus.
Jeg vil meg I mande hjem.
Hva skal du der, sagde Kristus.
Jeg skal bryte lem fra lem, rygg fra rygg.
Nei, sagde Kristus, du skal til ingen lita og ingen bryta. Du skal til deg I Bergen Blå, der skal du stemne på. I tre navn, Gud Faderens, Sønns og Helligånds.
Hi.
Hi.
Is this the Jesus podcast?
Almost. This is, what do you call it? Not a citation, like a magic formula.
Are you going to turn water into wine?
Well, I will...
I'm totally up for that.
This is for keeping your stock safe from evil women.
Hmm.
Livestock, that is.
Oh, okay. Not like your boxes of, your pallets of bottled water and stuff like that, and your baked beans in your apocalypse shelter.
Or your bonds and stocks.
Sure, yeah. Not those
well,
either.
It would perhaps work for that as well. So it was from 1594, actually, from the Bergen area.
Okay. And a little context, maybe? I heard that there was the word Bergen in there, right? But like,
yeah.
What's happening? For those listeners who don't speak Norwegian, what's happening?
Let's try to translate this on the fly. That couldn't go wrong at all.
Absolutely.
So our Lord Jesus... We're riding over a bridge, as he usually do, and on the bridge he met an evil woman, that is a witch, and he asked her, "Where are you going?" And she's answering, "I want to go to wherever man lives." And Christ asks her again, "What are you going to do there?" And she answers, "There I will break them limb by limb and back by back." Whereupon Christ says, "No, you won't.
Time out. Yeah,
you won't break in anybody. Where you are going is to Bergen, the blue." Which this is a bit ambiguous because this incantation. There was a word. That's a word, right? Incartation.
Say it again?
Incartation.
I'm not sure. Say more. Incarnation.
Incarnation.
Like separate instance?
Like something you say, like a magic...
Oh, incantation.
Incantation. Okay. Right. So this one is from the Bergen area. But Bergen can mean like a mountain or actually Bergen.
Right.
So well, that is
Bergen
left.
Bergen is like the mountain, right?
Yeah, and the idea of sending evil creatures into a mountain is a thing, either trolls or witches or something. Yeah, and it closes with saying the calling the Trinity.
Mm. Wow.
Yeah, since we are talking about magic and trolls and folklore and all that,
nice.
It seemed fitting.
And also Jesus Week, which I guess we may come back to.
And, well, I guess this is my cultural pick of the week, actually. For those of you who are on our Skype call, I have a pretty large book called Norwegian Witchcraft Formulas and Magic Recipes.
We just lost a bunch of people who now think you're a Satanist.
And, it's almost 1,000 pages.
Cool.
But many of them are pretty similar, actually.
So how many of the recipes are like for cake and stuff, and how many of them are destruction and breaking of the backs of stock and so on?
Well, it's mostly for preventing that.
Mostly, but not entirely.
Yeah, and there are also recipes for making women ready to marry or... lots of things that has to do with horses and
hopefully those two are not related.
both formulas for making someone drink spirits and keeping someone from drinking spirits. So,
wow. Well, I guess that covers the whole. Wow, this sounds very thorough.
I have a good one here. One for seeing your future spouse. So what you can do on Christmas Eve, after you have washed yourself at night, you can go out the one of the doors, and there's a verb I don't know, råber. You do something with the washing cloth, and then you will see your future husband.
Huh. Do you think ring it out, perhaps?
Something like that, perhaps. I think if you sort of circulate it or something.
Right.
Yeah.
Like you're getting ready to deliver a really good kind of towel snap in the changing rooms, right?
Something like that.
Okay.
Right. Enough with the magic formulas, perhaps later.
When you say that, but like, yeah.
Well, it's 1,000 pages. We have lots of content there.
I guess, right. Okay. This episode can be like pages 1 to 5, and then we'll see how that goes. How's the weather in Bergen today?
It is not that bad. It's a bit like spring is coming. Spring is coming.
But you don't want to call it yet.
Not yet. You have to pass 15 degrees first.
Oh, okay.
You're on 13 now.
I guess then it's officially spring here then. I actually thought about doing the show on the balcony today. I could have, I think, legitimately done that, but I don't think the Wi-Fi is good, and I didn't have time to figure out whether the Ethernet cable will stretch. But that's an indication of today's weather.
And I guess Utepils is old now in Oslo.
I have not had my first Utepils of the year, it must be said. Oh. I should fix that.
You should.
Other people in the office have, I think. I'm a bit slow like that.
Because that is kind of the spring, the first spring ritual. To have Utepils.
In the UK, it would be hearing the first cuckoo, or at least in England, it would be hearing the first cuckoo. But like everyone lives in cities now, so you never hear cuckoos. Even if they are nesting, sorry, it's kind of bird. Even if they're nesting in the city, which is doubtful, I guess. You would never hear them over all the city noise. I understood that was like the sign.
That doesn't sound as hyggelig as Utepils.
I agree. I'll take the beer. Thanks.
Should we just jump right into follow-up?
I think we should do that. Do you want to start with the follow-up about follow-up?
Yeah, because I listened to this other podcast called I never said it loud before.
Reconcilable
differences, which name is somewhat similar to another podcast we know about. I don't think it was derivative. Like consciously.
Not deliberately. We were coming from another angle, right? We were coming from the narcissism of small differences.
Yeah.
Anyway.
So, anyway, by these two podcast heroes of mine, and perhaps you as well.
Definitely. Definitely both mine.
Merlin Mann and John Siracusa. And in the last episode, they discussed legacy. And the lack thereof, and perhaps as some of you know, Merlin Mann is the inventor, the creator of the concept of Inbox Zero. This is inside baseball, I guess, but
a little bit, But at the same time, I'm wincing because, like, I think he would just be embarrassed if that was his kind of lasting legacy. And yet he acknowledges that it probably is.
Yeah, and they discuss that. But John Siracusa, he's an interesting guy. He had this podcast called Hypercritical on the 5x5 network, which is sort of responsible for the Fireside platform that we publish on.
Right.
And in that podcast, he allegedly invented the concept of the podcast follow-up.
Right. Go on.
Yeah, which it seems implausible because the concept seems so intuitive and given. But I actually think that he did.
I think in its current form, he can probably be credited as its author, yeah. Right? Like the idea that you would start a podcast with sort of stuff that had occurred in the intervening time period since the last episode and what it had to say or what you had forgotten to say about the previous points of discussion. So a little bit like, here's all the stuff that we couldn't fit into the last episode about this or that we felt was important to mention or that people have said to us about it or whatever.
And because he has provided me with hours and hours of free entertainment, I kind of wanted to pay back in a way. So now we have a point where a Wikipedia article we could be cited on this, right?
Totally.
Yeah. citation needed, right? So we have just created a data point that could be cited amongst others.
Well, it occurred to me that as two former academics, like, we're pretty up there with citing sources, right? Like, it seems really important to credit previous work due. And when I heard, I listened to this episode this morning of Reconcilable Differences, and I've never heard him sound so pained and anguished about a thing. This is a guy who, like, has a lot of care and attention for detail and so on, but is not, like, egocentric. You know, he's not like, it's got to be all about me. But this was just the one thing that he had kind of, it was like, this is my baby. This is the one thing that I feel I've bequeathed to the world that was actually mine and not just my extension of someone else's work. And no one, not even the people that I know and love best, like, recognizes that this came from me. So, yeah, we recognize that.
It's recognized them.
Cool. I'm glad you brought that up.
More follow-up.
Oh, so much follow-up. Where to start? Some of this... So the other thing is, some of this is not follow-up. Some of this is just stuff that happened this week. But, like, some of it is, I guess, when we get feedback from people, like when people actually listen to us implausibly and then send us emails or tweet us or whatever. Does that count as follow-up? Because they are talking about the stuff that we were talking about last time.
Perhaps this is follow-up evolved... This is a fork or follow-up.
Whoa. All right, let's stop with the meta. last time, we talked about frozen, frost in Norwegian. I became earwormed in ways that I did not believe possible by the, in particular, the song that we opened with.
Welcome to the rest of the humanity.
Yeah, but it wasn't even that song. It wasn't the song that is like the, you know, it was a different one, which, you know, small mercies, I guess, right? But the only cure for this appeared to have been to listen to it a lot and try and learn the lyrics so that I could sing it. I'm not going to sing for you today, but it's useful. And it was really helpful to me because it made me realize that correct pronunciation with good timing for singing is a really good exercise for learning Norwegian. And so I asked all of our colleagues for hints and tips of things that I could sing to. And it was like the floodgates opened. It was incredible. I have a Spotify playlist
so
that's like
bad.
200 tracks long. Oh, bad.
So much of that is so bad.
Yeah, but it's kind of tongue-in-cheek bad, right? It's like, it's fun bad, some of it.
It's stellar examples of sort of Norwegian music, but...
we started this conversation on the platform of just having listened to like a Disney musical, and while Disney are very good at what they do to the point where like a Disney song has become a genre in its own right, I'm not sure that we're starting from a platform of like superlative artisan quality here. It's good, but is it art? Nah. It's just a very good example of the genre.
Right. I think we should share this playlist. We should link to it.
Okay.
And people can make up their own judgments.
Absolutely.
But you're right. Music and singing is probably a good way to learn how to say things.
Mm.
Probably. I would guess.
Marta also pointed out that I'm getting a whole ton of Norwegian cultural references in there as well. So it's not like I'm just getting music practice and pronunciation practice. I'm getting like a whole bunch of references, which is cool. Have you started listening
to it?
Only a few. I didn't have very much time, and I didn't have time yesterday to actually pick one, find the lyrics online, and get to work. More on this as it develops.
And you will go into this by trying to learn to sing the thing, stuff, or just listen to it?
Oh, no, to repeat. Like, one of my very kind of intermittent pleasures in life is to find a song that I enjoy that's difficult to sing, because it requires a lot of words per minute or something, and find the lyrics online and try to do a decent job with it. And ideally memorize them, but I'm not that great at doing that, so...
You should check out the Fifth Element soundtrack.
I don't remember what's in that musically.
The Fifth Element musically?
Wait. You mean like the movie, the Luc Besson?
Yeah.
Or something else?
The movie. There's a scene there with in an opera house or something.
It's a long time since I saw it. Oh. What happens?
Well, yeah, you have to check it out on YouTube afterwards.
can I just say that without YouTube and Wikipedia, this podcast would be literally 5 minutes long.
Without YouTube or Wikipedia, any podcast wouldn't be longer than 5 minutes, I guess.
Touché.
So yeah, looking forward to your discoveries.
Yeah, like I said, more on this as it comes.
This is years of follow-up to come, I guess.
I know, right? I know. Last time we talked about musicals, so we talked about Disney and Frost specifically. I forgot to name check the Jungle Book. I listened back to the episode, and you asked me like, "What's my favorite musical?" And like, it's the Jungle Book. It's a no brainer. And I think what I like about it is that it seems like a big exception in Disney movie terms, because the songs in that are not really Disney songs. It's jazz. And they're a little bit different from the format and style of what has become kind of very, very regularized set of rules about what a Disney song is like. And I think that's one of the reasons I like it. I think they're qualitatively good, and I like that the kind of genre that they're in much better than I actually like Disney as a genre for songs. I also think it's a great movie.
Yeah, as a Brit, I guess sort of exotic colonial situations there are appealing.
Ouch. Ouch, man, that hurts. Yeah, let's overlook that particular part. I don't know, it tickles me. I think it's a fun movie from a very different time. Like, a Disney movie now is a very different thing than a Disney movie then.
Should we have a post-colonialist klaxon?
I think so. It would just be constantly going off in the background, and you'd actually have to filter it out with Logic Pro.
Right.
Other follow-up. We talked also last week about Norwegians discussing where other Norwegians are from. And this is a thing that I notice, is that when two Norwegians meet each other the first time, it's totally normal for one of them to say, "Where are you from?" and for a conversation to ensue about their respective dialects. And this is fascinating, because this is a conversation that almost never happens in the UK. I don't know why not. I think in part maybe because it's heaven. Like, to have that conversation is kind of laden with sort of class prejudice and or assumption. Like, if I heard that conversation in the UK, it would not necessarily be taking place in a positive light. It might be, but it might not. It's a rarer conversation, and when it does, it's a kind of "where are you from" kind of It's not necessarily a good conversation all the time. That said, if two people meet and one of them's like, and they're from relatively close, then yeah, they're going to have that conversation because they're trying to work out why the other person doesn't sound quite like them, but almost. I can totally see that scenario. But it feels like a more laden conversation there, whereas here people just seem completely delighted by it.
Yeah, I guess you're right. I'm not sure what it... I think it's a... It's probably mostly just small talk. It's a conversation that is easy to have.
Like the weather.
Yeah, something like that. And, yeah. But isn't this a thing in the States as well? I seem to always, on podcasts or interviews or whatever, the question often comes up, where you're from. And the ASCII will try to remember if he or she has been there or know of the place and so on. And in the States, it sort of makes sense because it's pretty vast country.
It is huge.
But Norway, well, it's long. But we are also just 5 million people, so there are so many places that you can be from.
Right. But, you're spread very thinly.
Mm.
Very much like the Marmite I hope to one day buy you.
I'm not looking forward to that.
You might be one of the 50% of people who think it's just brilliant.
Well, this will be, I guess, in one of our live shows.
Live tasting?
The food,
yes.
The food
yes,
episode.
Yes, we should do that. Oh my God, that would be amazing. Completely. That's a very, very interesting idea. I'm going to give that a lot more thought. More follow-up?
Indeed.
The ship canal.
Yeah. So one of your honest discoveries about this country, your contribution to sort of the outside perspective, is the observation that we like to drill holes in mountains.
Yep.
To put witches in them, I guess.
And other things.
Yeah. So this time, boats or ships?
I'm in awe. So they will be the world's first ship tunnel. Drilling through a mountain, moving something like 3 million cubic meters of rock. I forget exactly, but it's a lot. And the ostensible rationale for this, as far as I've been able to read about it, the ostensible rationale is that what this is doing is allowing ships to go from place A to place B without passing a section of sea that is very rough and I assume risky if you're carrying cargo. But I have not been able to, like, the cost of this thing is in the hundreds of millions of dollars to kind of translate it into international money. And I'm just staggered that it's financially worth doing. I understand that from a DIY project point of view, this is a completely legitimate kind of preoccupation for Norwegians. That's fine. It's an interesting project. You carry on. That's lovely. But at the same time, is this really financially worthwhile to like move millions of cubic meters of rock aside? Because it's going to take like several years and it's going to cost a lot of money.
Several years as 3 to 4 years, which sounds pretty effective, you ask me.
Yeah, me too. Are they just going to like blow up that whole section of country with dynamite and go, yeah, that'll do?
Perhaps, I haven't thought about this before, but perhaps making space in mountains could be our new oil. Sort of a continuation of the drilling activity, but
do you think there's an international market for that?
Yeah.
Yeah?
It could scale. There's some expertise going into that thing, I guess.
There, There is a lot of expertise on just wondering whether this is a thing that countries would pay for. Drilling as a service.
But yeah, fun fact, this coastline, which they don't want to send ships through, my brother is actually surfing a lot there.
Are these two things perhaps related?
Perhaps.
Amazing.
Something to do with waves, I guess. But yeah, I think this is pretty cool, actually.
I think it's amazing. I'm just staggered that it's financially worthwhile. Because it's not even, like, the detours, mileage-wise, it's not that far, right? It's really, I can't put a number on it, but it can't be more than 100 kilometers of detour. It's not huge.
So they list some positive consequences of this. There's the value of making it easier to have ships go back and forth to wherever. Increased tourism.
When people come to look at the canal.
Yeah, something like that. And okay. Some trickle-down
jobs.
Things for fisheries and other things. It isn't obvious. I agree.
It's not. It's not. I think it's just someone got money to fund their hobby of drilling holes. Good luck to them. It's fascinating.
This is what you can do when you pay a lot of taxes.
I guess so. We've covered like the social welfare network and decent education and all of that kind of thing. So Maslow's hierarchy of tools, basically. Like, okay, what can we drill now? Wow. Okay, next. Skam is back this week. This is big news in Norway, the TV show. Coming back for one final...
It's big news in the world.
Yeah, it has become a thing. Leaving aside my immense frustration that I'm going to be on an airplane tomorrow when it starts airing again. This is very annoying. It's very exciting. I've been trying to catch up. I will not catch up on season 3 before it starts, but that's just my hard cheese. That's just going to have to be how it is. But the thing that it reminded me about that we have not talked about is the absolute insanity of episode listings. So if you're used to these in Norway, it seems to be that the way NRK, at least, which is the national broadcaster, it took me a long time to figure this out, frankly. Like, I was looking at these episode titles and just going, hang on. So if you look at, like, Skam Season 1, I'm trying to find it online. And now I can't type either. Here we go. And the first episode is called 1:11. And if you've never seen this notation before, it's crazy town. You're like, okay. But if you're trying to catch up and it's like 3:11, 4:11, okay. And then you go to the next season and the episodes are like 1:12, 2:12, 3:12. And you're like, I'm not getting this. Where in this episode title does it actually tell me what season I'm in? Because I'm looking, when I look at these numbers, I'm looking for an episode number and I'm looking for a season number. Right? Like I might expect seasons to go 1.01, 1.02, 1.03. That would be like the first season. And then the second season is 2.01. And this doesn't behave like this at all. And this is how NRK lists all of the episodes for all the TV, as far as I can tell. And it took me ages to figure out that the second number is actually out of the total number of episodes. So like 1:12 is actually 1 of 12. 8:12 is 8 of 12. And that the reason that this varies between seasons is because different seasons have different number of episodes. But it took me ages to crack that. And it's probably super obvious to you, but it was just absolutely incomprehensible to me. I was like, where in this number is the season? This doesn't make any sense.
I think this is something we could call a pee under the mattress.
Yeah.
This is something I guess NRK has done to annoy UX designers. Where's the information taxonomy here? This makes no sense.
Right.
Well, I guess this is an inheritance from the old linear broadcast reality, where you in the newspaper listings, right, would have the, this is episode X of Total, and you didn't have the opportunity to switch seasons. That was somewhat irrelevant, right? So, yeah.
That would make sense. It's a skeuomorphic kind of quality, I guess, right? Ish.
Yeah.
It's an overused and misapplied word, if ever there was. But
if I had a UX bell, I would ring it now for saying skeuomorphic. But okay.
Thanks. Mine's just constantly ringing. It's a nuisance.
And what's even more frustrating, I guess, that you look at scum in the sort of parental old way, namely by looking at the compiled episodes.
Young man, what are you implying?
But a true scum fan would look at the daily clips
that is released on
the website, and they don't have a number at all, just a date and a timestamp.
And that's awesome if you're up to speed, but my entire experience with scum so far has been that I'm trying to catch up to, like, reality. So at the EULA board, when you all were, like, disappearing off to get the latest update, I was like, I haven't caught up, stop it, this is just spoiler town. I was really hoping that this week would be the one where I would actually be able to join in with everybody, but I'm going to be away, so I'm not really sure about that. We'll see how it goes. Just one season of Scum, just with everyone. That's what I'd like, in real time.
And this is the last season, so I guess you have to catch up.
Well, I'm going to have to catch up or just kiss season 3 goodbye and get on with it. So, yeah.
I wouldn't recommend that. But, yeah. Hmm. Scum is back.
It is. We're all happy about that.
It will be a very exciting season, I guess.
I'm very excited. It has as its core character the most badass person. So good.
We are back to the cabin, I guess. You posted a link to Aftenposten, which is one of our large national newspapers.
Right.
Do you care to introduce it?
Well, I listed this as Norwegian problems because the kind of intro text to this is can all kinds of crisp bread be left over the winter in your hut, in your cabin? Does if Solo, which is like Fanta or it's like an orange soda drink here, does it have the same shelf life, whether it's in a can or in a plastic bottle? If your chocolate has got this kind of grey-white kind of cast on it, is it, you know, like, should you throw it out? And these are cabin problems, basically. This is lovely. This is just total Norwegian problems of, like, all that stuff that you've left in the cabin since the last time you were there. Because it's spring now, obviously, and everyone's thinking about going to their cabin again if it wasn't the kind of cabin that you could go to in the winter.
I guess a part of cabin life overlaps with the survivalist life in terms of planning for foods that has a long shelf life.
Are you saying that Norwegians are inherently more prepper than other countries?
You would expect that, but less so now, because I just recently listened to a podcast from the more intellectual newspaper, a weekly newspaper called Morgenbladet, which is more academically inclined or something. And there they had an architect who wrote an article on the new cabin architecture. And now we are making these cabin villages in the mountains where they are almost like regular houses.
Right.
And people live pretty close to each other, which is sort of juxtaposed earlier cabin life where you would have this spot and your next neighbor would be miles away. And the question arises, people, they go to the mountain and go to the cabin to be at peace, in peace, right? From also from other people. But now that isn't so much the case anymore.
What did happened? Did the article talk about why this is happening?
A bit, and it's mostly, it's hard to reckon about, but it's mostly because of there are more people that can afford cabins, and they seek the mountain life, like the nature and so on. But there hasn't been this architectural, I guess, conversation about how this should be planned. So you had a huge demand and people have seen the opportunity to build.
It sounds like what you're saying in this very sparsely populated long country of 5 million people that Norway is becoming dangerously crowded.
Yeah.
This must be stopped.
I guess we should just name check that there's a thing called Mountain Lebensraum. Moving on.
For real?
No, I don't think so. Perhaps I wouldn't be surprised.
I think the Norwegian equivalent of that would just be a courteous and respectful distance.
But to be serious, the journalist asked about this, if people are okay with it, with sort of this crowdedness.
Right.
And so far it seems that they are.
Like, when you say crowdedness, this is only by Norwegian standards, right? This isn't Tokyo.
No. I guess by Norwegian standards.
I'm just imagining Norwegian guy now who's complaining because his nearest neighbours are like only 200 metres away and this is just unlivable.
I went to the mountain at Easter to have some peace and quiet, and I'm so tired of my neighbors, and we drove up 3 hours to the mountain side, and there, who do I see there? Yeah, my neighbor has bought the next door cabin, and what should I do? I don't know. I have to go on really long ski trips and drink a lot at night, and yeah, I'm looking forward to get back to the city. Next year, I will take a city Easter. Something like that?
Pretty much. Norwegian problems. I feel bad for you, son.
We watched another movie about Disney. About Disney? No, from Disney.
Yes and no. Let's just make that a yes and.
Okay.
It's a Pixar movie. And this became the hub of a conversation in our house about the distinction between Disney movies and Pixar movies.
Right.
But I'm interested to know if you would be able to sum up what you think is the difference between Disney movies and Pixar movies. The relevance, for those listening and wondering where has this podcast gone, there is relevance to the show.
Where Steve Jobs had a finger in it. Which isn't something you should say, I now just realized. But,
no, please never say that again.
Computers? Lots of rendering? I don't know.
The difference between Disney and Pixar movies.
Stop thinking about the finger. Well, Pixar, they are known for not being perfectionists, but perhaps saying no a lot and have this sort of method.
Steve Jobs standards.
Yeah.
Do you think people in Disney say no less?
Now I wonder, because Pixar made Cars.
I'm told it's not very good. I haven't seen it, but I'm told it's not great. By Pixar standards.
I guess there must be other forces at Disney movies.
I think that's the LucasArts branch of the whole enterprise.
It's difficult to talk about Disney as one company, as a thing now, because it's so huge, and I guess you have, yeah, like LucasArts and the new Star Wars franchise. Right.
No, thanks. My bringing LucasArts into it was just me punning on Force, but we can move on.
Disney now owns Star Wars. Think about that for a minute.
I'm trying not to.
But yeah, back to the difference between Pixar and Disney. What did you conclude, if you did?
I think we conclude that, at the risk of sounding like the liberal arts graduate I am not, that Pixar movies are way more heterogeneous and Disney movies are quite homogeneous. I originally came at this with the premise that the distinction of a Disney movie is pretty much that the hero or heroine doesn't have a mother, or if they do, that they have a wicked stepmother. There's like an absent mother figure. And I put a link in the last episode show notes about some reasons why this was, slash is. But then we started talking a bit more about like the fact that Disney has a cookie cutter approach to movies to some extent. Like, you get the same characters recurring. They reuse a lot of the animation for those same characters. There are kind of archetypes, really classic archetypes, that repeat a lot in Disney movies. And Pixar have had a lot more freedom to invent their own thing. And it means that the shape of a Pixar movie is very different than the shape of a Disney movie. The shape of a Disney movie is pretty largely predictable. And it meant that when we watched Brave yesterday, it didn't quite go in directions I expected, because the last thing I'd really seen was Frozen. And so I was kind of set up for something more in that vein. And of course, it doesn't do that. It goes a very different direction. And of course, the more explicit difference is that, of course, there is a mother in this movie. And in fact, her relationship with the central character is the backbone of the movie. That's what the movie is about, and that's about as un-Disney as you can actually get.
Well, I want to give you a B on that thesis as a liberal arts.
That was just the intro, man. That was the kind of intro text. Like, I've got like a whole argument, but we don't have that kind of time, and that's not really why we watch the movie. So.
Yeah, it's pretty apt for, I guess, a Freudian literal analysis or something.
Do not put me in that bucket, sir.
Why shouldn't I? Tell me about your father. Right. So, yeah. Yeah, I guess you're right. Perhaps. I try to think about all the Disney movies now, and the mothers, or the lack thereof. But yeah, I guess they have a history of many bad mothers.
Absent and or bad.
Yeah. Hmm.
There was a purpose, though, to watching Brave.
Yeah, because Brave is the Frost of Scotland, I guess.
Right. That's the theory. So this is our the other half of the cultural exchange, right? So I'm fascinated by your kind of take on it, I guess. Like, have you been to Scotland? I'm just checking.
No, I haven't, actually.
Okay, should fix that. But what, I don't know, like, I'm sure it's not the first time you've seen Scotland depicted in a movie, but what did you make of it as a whole? Never mind the Scotland thing, just what did you make of the movie?
There was a lot of sort of Scotland stereotypes,
yeah,
and tropes, and I was a bit embarrassed because we have done this podcast for episodes now, and I have sort of forgotten all the almost all the Scotland tropes, stereotypes for some reason.
Have I managed to cure you of those?
We haven't talked about the kilts or the clans or the whiskey. Well, perhaps a bit. We mentioned it in the Christmas episode, but and all that stuff.
Okay.
And here it was.
Right. Did it feel like it was the kind of tourist layer, the shortbread and whiskey layer for... Or...
Not really. I guess because they could have done a lot worse.
I'm trying From to imagine what the really ridiculous version of this looks like.
Well, we have the Mel Gibson Scottish person, right?
Yeah, you're right. That's worse.
but also something was similar. That they showcased the beautiful Scottish landscape and nature.
Hmm. Did you feel that it got about the same level of treatment? Because we talked about Frozen last time, which maybe only showed one aspect of the Norwegian landscape, which was a lot of snow, mostly.
Well, perhaps a bit more, actually.
Hmm.
Well, in the start, at least.
Hmm.
But it also had... And I don't know enough about... Sort of the Scottish folklore and tradition. But there were some, I guess. The wisps. Are that
right.
a thing?
It's totally a thing. I was interested, actually, that there was a Norwegian word for those. And I read a little bit on Wikipedia after, and it seems like the idea of a will-o'-the-wisp, or like this kind of marsh gaslight thing that kind of is interpreted as being various spirits or whatever... it seems to be a pretty international thing. There was stuff on the Wikipedia page about it where they talked about it in Finland. I don't know if it's a thing in Norway, is it?
I guess that is something you could call a fe.
Mm.
Which is...
Yeah.
Sometimes a fairy, perhaps.
Yeah, fae.
Other times,
sometimes
so,
people use
yeah.
the word fae as well. Yeah, fae. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, possibly. It doesn't, in my recollection, doesn't come up a lot in Scotland. Like, it's a known thing. I think it's maybe more of an English thing, or like the English and Welsh marsh kind of bit. Marshes, marches, I don't even know. Yeah. Yeah.
So what would be the more typical Scottish mystical creature thing?
We've got a whole bunch of things. The Kelpie is the first one that comes to mind, which is a sea creature that, depending on like whose depiction of it, you can see it as a horse in the breaking waves of the sea. And it comes out of the sea and turns into a person, often a man. And they may kind of form relationships with people on land, but they always have to go back to the sea. There's a brief fleeting reference to this in the movie Rob Roy, which came out a long time ago now, thinking of other Scottish movies. That's a good start. There's a whole bunch of other kind of pixies and fairies and things like that as well that are probably pretty standard, and I would imagine maybe this is similar to things in Norway. They mention trolls briefly in the movie, but only as an insult, I think. It's not actually as a that exists. I think it's just to call someone an ugly troll or something like that. But I did make a note. Was there anything else that was sort of like, oh, here's something I don't understand that's mythological or that's...
Well, the focus on bears as in the animal,
right.
Not the liquid.
Indeed. We used to have bears. There aren't bears in the wild in Scotland anymore. I know there are in Norway still a few. Someone saw one not that far from Oslo a couple of months ago. It was in the papers.
Didn't you know that in Norway we have ice bears in our streets and we have to have guns to keep them away? That is partly true, actually. In Svalbard, you have to.
Mm. Ice bear equals polar bear for those still confused. But it's called an ice bear in Norway. I really like that. That's a lovely word. I don't know. Anything else that was like, huh, I need to ask Chris about this.
Yeah. Were you aware of the clans? The clan structure? Is that existent anymore?
Only in the kind of... I think maybe some people still meet up in the sense that there are like bodies of people internationally who still like to meet up, like the Masons and the other people like that, to have a belonging thing. Like, it doesn't... There's a relationship that was sort of largely reinvented by the Victorians between your clan and your tartan and your kind of identity and all of that stuff. People did used to live in clans, genuinely. They used to fight with other clans. That's how that went down. So that's kind of legit. Trying to place this in time, by the way, there's a throwaway reference to someone having fought the Vikings, and then also something about the Romans follows right on the back of that in the script. And I was like, well, okay, but those two things in the UK don't really overlap in time. They're separated by probably a good 300 years. So, like, when is this? I'm well willing to believe that there were clans of people living at that time. They didn't have brightly coloured tartans like we would have today, but they played down the tartan thing, actually. It was kind of... I felt that was acceptable. I went and read to check my facts on Wikipedia, if one can check facts on Wikipedia. I went to do that afterwards to find out like whether that was completely outrageous. And tartan as a kind of concept, without necessarily having that strong clan association, was just like a way that people wove cloth for a long time. So that stacks up fine. The position of this thing in time is very uncertain, if it even exists in like a real thing. My husband made me aware that there's a theory that all the Pixar movies occur in the same universe. But I need to think about that some more.
There are also a similar theory for the Tarantino movies.
Yes, I've heard that one.
It just reminded me, because I asked this question, and I think partly the reason is that there were this BBC TV series a couple of years ago, which got really popular in Norway, called Monarch of the Glen.
I've never seen it. It's quite old, isn't it?
From early 2000s, I guess.
Sounds maybe about right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which I guess it was this... The protagonist was... he lived in London and he inherited... This castle hotel or something. And, he had to return to his old surroundings and be the new...
Laird.
Laird, yeah. And hilarity ensues, I guess.
Is it a comedy?
Well, it's a drama comedy thing. Yeah, romance,
right.
All that. And it has run several times in Norway. And I guess Norway has a thing about British TV dramas. Because we have this, but another one, which also belongs to the traditional Norwegian Saturday ritual, namely Heartbeat.
Oh! That goes back. I never really watched that either, but I know it exists and who was in it. Wow.
Oh, that green grass. He's a real... yeah, so...
wow.
Yeah. So we have affinities for British TV series about how to be in Britain, I guess, or the daily life of Britain, more or less.
I guess by being different, it's kind of exotic. I'm not sure these are like the finest examples of TV, but...
I'm not sure if it's exotic or familiar.
Maybe a bit of both. Maybe that's the appeal.
Yeah, something like that, I guess. But yeah. Let's return to Brave. Yeah, I asked about the quarreling and the clans.
Right. Yeah, plausible, I guess.
Are you a quarrelsome people?
Not really, but like any kind of tribal society, it's gonna, you know, there's gonna be kind of clan beefs, right? That's how that goes. There was one fleeting throwaway. I'm just looking through the list of things that I thought were kind of tropes. Fleeting throwaway, which did make me laugh nevertheless, about meanness. So there's a stereotype that Scots are kind of stingy and mean with their money and their things. And it's this lovely thing where they decide that they're going to celebrate and go to the wine cellar or whatever, or whiskey cellar, and get like all the good stuff. And the king says, "Bring the tiniest glasses that we have." That was nice. There were no carrots in this movie, I'm sorry to say. There was caber tossing.
Yeah, when you throw a large piece of wood. Is that the thing?
Yeah, but like it's a whole skill. You're making it sound like some kind of casual carpentry. Yeah. I had to look up. I did not know, actually. I had to look this up, that how you win at caber tossing is it's about form, it's about style, it's about the extent to which the piece of this giant log, let's not call it a piece of wood, this is a log.
Sure it is.
Long. It's very long. Hush. It's the form, it's the, like, to what extent does that go end over end and not just kind of get slung. So it's all about form, it's not the distance that you toss.
There were also horse keeping.
There was. And I'm interested in one particular aspect of that.
Mm.
But tell me your thoughts.
There were this particular scene where the protagonists were a bit, I guess, frustrated. And she did a really bad job keeping that stable. She threw away the fresh hay from the horse. She emptied the fresh water. What the... Yeah. Poor horse.
That's funny that you would notice.
And the horse
things.
Didn't get the one apple. She ate all the apples herself.
I guess she was pretty frustrated and distracted. Let's assume that that was not par for the course and that she is... I don't know why I'm mixing metaphors from golf with horsekeeping, but okay, sure. The note that I made at the time was in the bit where they're very frightened and they're going to see the...
witch.
Not the clan MacGuffin, but the witch. The actual MacGuffin of the story, who is the witch, I guess. I made a note when... It's quite a frightening scene, like it's very atmospheric and stuff, and I made a note that says, "The horse's ears should be back, not forwards."
Yeah, that's cool.
So,
I didn't notice that. Yeah.
Factually inaccurate.
Yeah.
Anyway.
1 star.
Right. what did you make of the accents?
I didn't make... It sounded Scottish.
Okay, generically. All right.
Yeah.
Many of these are sort of quite well-known Scottish and variously British actors. From all over, to be fair. Did you notice the guy speaking in Doric? Oh, we have to talk about that. That was wonderful.
"This is a grand idea. Give us our own say in choosing our fate."
"What?
Aye. Why shouldn't we choose?"
"But she's the princess."
"I didn't pick her out. It was your idea."
"And you? You feel the same way? It's just no fair marking his feck for the hand of the queen. It doesn't went to anybody yet."
Yeah,
guys, in fact.
I noticed that I didn't get anything.
Right.
But I watched the YouTube clip afterwards and cheated by looking in the comment section, but yeah.
Right. It's great. I was so tickled when this came up. So Doric is a dialect spoken in Scotland. It's the only one that I can ever think of when people ask me about Scottish dialects that's not actually going into like Gaelic, which is a whole separate language. But it's great. It's impenetrable. If you're not used to it, the Aberdeen, well, it's not really Aberdeen, but like the inland from Aberdeen is where people speak this. And that accent in itself is quite strong. But then like you throw in the kind of what British people would refer to as dialect, which is like lots of different words. And it just becomes this delightful kind of thing that's very hard to pass. It's great. I loved it. I love that they put it in. I'm not good enough. I think the only word I can think of in Doric is like loon, which means kind of guy or boy. And even that, I'm not sure. Now I'm wondering if that's a girl, but I think that's a guy. But yeah, that was great that made it into the movie. I was so pleased.
And I heard some also there were some differences between the characters. I could hear that, but yeah.
I had two reactions to two of the characters, actually three if you count the crow. I don't know if what the crow was going for. It was just straight up American from my point of view. I looked the guy up afterwards and yeah, American. But the mother character, I was like, this does not exist. This is like a reasonable facsimile, but it's not correct. There's something just not quite there about it. And the mother is played by Emma Thompson, who is English, but whose mother, I believe, was Scottish. I think Emma Thompson's done kind of stronger Scottish accents on the record and probably been more consistent. This was a bit weird. This was very vanilla and very, very lightweight.
But didn't the mother... wasn't she supposed to sort of try for a more... excuse me, old Scots, civilized.
I think the impression was that she was kind of...
leaning southwards, perhaps?
Maybe. I think she was definitely kind of less... Well, the implication was heavily... It was kind of consistent with her character, right? That she was a little bit more kind of... I don't even know what the word would be.
Posh?
Maybe. But there was just something about it that was just not... It didn't feel entirely organic. She didn't really put any obvious feet wrong. It just didn't feel entirely organic. The one that I had the most difficulty with was the witch. And it pains me to say this because Julie Walters is wonderful. But there were just so many points in that where I was just like, this is right in the uncanny valley. This is not an accent. This just keeps going off into weird territory.
To be fair, in the uncanny valley, we have trolls, but witches also.
I think so. Yeah, certainly in this instance.
So who had the if you could qualify that, the best Scottish accent in this movie?
All the Scottish people, duh. there was a very West Coast slant to it, actually. Kelly MacDonald's got a very kind of lightweight and very easy accent to understand. I love Billy Connolly. I grew up with Billy Connolly on vinyl, being funny. I love his voice. It's just so distinctive. So I don't know. I love them both, really. They're very different, obviously, but that's partly about their voices as well. So Craig Ferguson, I can take or leave.
As I guess many can.
Oh, burn.
Right. Yeah, did you feel, you asked me about Frost, if their take on Norway were on the spot or in a way off. How did you ask the podcast talking Scottish, I keep botching that word, person feel about this movie as a representation of your home land?
So first of all, because it's animation, it feels like it gets a pass because it's already one layer of remove from reality. So this is now a kind of, this is a depiction that, A, it's in a film, so it's inherently a depiction, but B, it's also it's given up a layer of reality. So it's in that kind of specific, to completely abstract representation continuum described by comics guy, Scott someone. His name escapes me. We'll put a link in the show notes. It's already gone down the abstract path quite a lot by being animated. That said, a lot of it's kind of interesting, like to look at the landscape stuff particularly, which gets quite a lot of time early in the movie. It's very heavily, actually all the way through the movie, it's very heavily in this tradition of kind of Scottish romantic landscape painting of the, I guess, 18th and 19th centuries. And you can see a lot of that in it, whether or not that's deliberate. It feels like it's, it feels like it's sort of, it's pulling on that tradition. And that is a very romanticised version of Scotland. The whole of Scotland does not tragically look like that. We have kind of dirty cities, you know, and you know, suburbs that have poverty in and all kinds of things. So it is this kind of very idealised, shortbread tin kind of version of Scotland. So I guess it's just more of that, like, you know, I've lived through kind of Braveheart, for example, as a kind of, I'm pretty used to Scotland being treated in that way. Have I answered your question?
This movie is like Braveheart with the heart.
Ha! See what we did there. I'm not offended by anything in it. I think it was charming enough to kind of justify the sort of stereotype excesses. At the same time, I don't look at it and think this is what people need to understand about Scotland. Because it's not really about, that's not what the story's about. It's a universal, we were talking about this a little bit actually yesterday, is that like the theme of this movie or the themes of this movie are kind of really universal, and that's one of the things that Pixar does really well, right? Is it just takes a thing that could translate and it puts a particular skin on it. Like if you're a web developer, you'd kind of reskin it with CSS and things like that, but it to make it either localized, as with voice talent, you know, that gets swapped out when this stuff is shown around the world, or actually by making it look different. But you could have replayed, as my husband pointed out, you could have replayed this story almost anywhere in the world with kind of local detail, and it would have resonated as a story, I think.
Yeah, actually this movie reminded me about a movie I grew up with called, in Norwegian, Ronja Røverdatter, or in English, The Robber's Daughter. And this is a filmatization of the Astrid Lindgren book.
Hmm.
The same author behind the Pippi Longstockings.
Right.
So
I didn't
she
read it.
Is known for strong female protagonist.
Hmm.
And the female protagonist in this movie, Ronja, is pretty similar to, I forgot completely the name.
Merida? Wasn't a name I've ever heard before. It sounds a bit like a Scottish attempt at Meredith or something. I don't know.
Yeah. They're pretty similar.
Hmm. The feminist score of this movie was very high. It passes the Bechdel test extremely well. There's like, although superficially, there's lots of time spent between mother and daughter, two female characters discussing ostensible suitors. Actually, most of the rest of the story is them talking about things other than the man, which is really nice. So, lots of points there.
And the man is reduced to dumb buffoons.
Yeah, sorry about that. It would be nice if we could have both in the same movie. Like, you know, it would do everyone better service.
I guess this, the men should have their due, I guess.
You suppose
now it's time,
right? Yeah you guys have
to restore the
we can just skip that bit and then move on.
Did you have you wrote that you had an alternative title for this movie,
right? I was thinking about the movie a lot afterwards and about like what the bits of the movie were about and how much of the movie did X and how much of the movie did Y. And I came to the conclusion that a very large chunk of this, and way more than I had been expecting, of the movie could be described as bare Pictionary. Where you've basically just got like a person trying to talk with a bear.
Yeah.
And the bear can't talk, but wishes to convey meaning. And when I thought about how much of the movie was actually about that, I was surprised. It was amusing. Maybe a little bit more of the movie was about that than I wanted it to be. But I'm not their target audience, I surmise.
Could we call it the bare necessities?
I wondered that. I had an entertaining conversation with my husband about how much of the movement from Baloo and the Jungle Book they had reused for this bear. Because it's all that. It's like Disney are all about reusing their animations, right? Mm. And Everything is a Remix. I feel like we should quote everything and cite everything that we're actually making reference to in today's episode out of John Siracusa. But yeah, like Everything is a Remix talks about this, right? And the reuse of big-assed, waddling kind of creatures. But I also thought they did a nice job transferring the animation of someone who had been depicted as a human into an animal. I thought they preserved some of the characteristics of that quite well. That was nice to see. I made a note of things that should make you feel at home. Deer skulls mounted on shields, stuffed animals, weather, and the Viking-looking ships in the final scene.
Yeah, I made a remark of that.
Yeah.
They're very Viking-y.
Yeah.
Viking-ish. Yeah.
It was noticeable. It's entirely possible that that's consistent with the ships of the period. I have no idea. But it looked like a scene directly out of the TV series Vikings, so...
I'm not sure about the temporal aspects there, but could it be that some of them indeed were descendants of actual Vikings?
Plausible.
Welcome to the History podcast.
Right. Yeah. They were a little fuzzy. They were a little fuzzy on the historical period. Also...
Right.
Yeah, people keep telling me that, like, actually the Vikings didn't do much in the way of settling Scotland. As far as I know, it was kind of Northumbria and a lot of Ireland. And I don't know how much of Scotland they actually got to.
I guess we just took your stuff.
Yeah. Well, if it wasn't the English, it was you guys. So, yeah, whatever. We're over it. We're not bitter.
Sure.
Uh-huh.
Right. Have we exhausted the topic of Brave?
I think probably just about.
Is it an official Small Differences recommendation?
I don't know.
I found it very funny. I laughed aloud plenty of times.
My husband laughed quite a lot. He's a bright guy. He's got a PhD. What makes him laugh? People hurting themselves. So there was plenty
lots
in there.
Of slapstick.
Right. There was a great deal of slapstick.
I guess I laughed for the same reasons, and I guess the reason is resentment. For you have to be a certain type to get a PhD, which probably mean that your time in school were challenging on some levels. Moving on. You wanted to talk about this week being the big Norwegian Jesus Festival.
Right. Or Easter, as people apparently like to call it. Or Påske, as it's called here.
I think perhaps we have to put a pin in that.
That's fine.
Next time.
We have another episode next week, right? So, right after the big Norwegian Jesus Festival.
We have if I guess someone... arises from the dead again.
You think that's likely?
To go to Glasgow or something. No, Glastonbury. Glasgow, Glastonbury.
Yeah, they're like right next to each other.
Yeah.
If you're listening from the US, they're right next to each other. Do you want to talk cultural picks of the week?
Yeah, let's do that. I guess you have to start.
Okay. Last week, when we were talking about accents and dialects and stuff, I brought up the concept of legibility. And this is a blog post by a guy called Venkatesh Rao. And he talks about an idea. It's not his idea. He talks about an idea from a book. I cannot remember the author's name. It is credited right at the top of the article. I should say that. Everyone waits for the internet to load. Right, James C. Scott wrote a book called Seeing Like a State, How Certain Schemes to Improve the Human Condition Have Failed. To do a very bad job of summing up Venkatesh Rao's very good job of summing up the book, In essence, the idea is that when societies and states try to replicate a thing but better, they do a terrible job of it. Or when they try to design systems to fundamentally to improve you know, the lives and existences of citizens, they do a bad job. And they do a bad job because the many layers and complexities of societal infrastructure and the things that cause other things and the systems inherent in that are illegible. And they're particularly illegible if you're coming at this from a position of what he calls authoritarian high modernism, which is to say, so high modernism is the idea that everything can be solved with kind of logic and science and things like that, which is not, in my view, an objectionable thing, but it perhaps doesn't allow terribly much room for other stuff or people's interest in other stuff. And then the authoritarian version of this is doing stuff like building the Brazilian official capital city of Brasilia, which is a very kind of inorganic way of developing a complicated system and saying, well, let's build a city and it should be like this, and idealistically it will do this, this, and this. And then when people actually move there, the reality is very different. So sorry, I've gone quite deep in this already. But this is just to give a little bit of background to this thing. So the idea of legibility is that complexity is, certainly from that authoritarian high modernist perspective, is super difficult to get to grips with. And you will never, you can never. And so when you build things that fail, they fail for that reason, or at least partly including that reason. And one of the things I was thinking about a couple of weeks ago was about legibility, and he talks about this towards the end of the article, but it's a thing, it's a sticky concept that has just stuck with me ever since I read this article, is that, okay, but what does this idea of legibility, what does that mean kind of at the personal level? And as someone who's currently trying to come to grips with life in a new country, which has different cultures, I'm very aware that lots of the cultural facets of Norway are illegible to me. And they're illegible to me because of the ways that I think about life, which are heavily formed by having grown up in the UK. And it's very difficult to see outside of that framework. And they're also illegible to me because of the constraints around learning a language and the constraints around the kinds of information that, as a foreigner, I tend to get. Like, a big goal for me, obviously, is to become as good at Norwegian as I can to try and improve the extent to which Norway as a society and as a country and everything else becomes legible to me, because the better that, the better my language becomes, the more able I am to parse the stuff that comes with that. And, for example, that's a big reason why I'm keen to learn Norwegian songs. It's not just a pronunciation exercise. It's not a linguistic thing in that way. It's also, I'm going to get some culture. I'm going to get some memes and cultural references and stuff like that, which makes more things legible to me, because many, many of them are currently completely illegible. And the kind of the back end of this train of thought really was, well, okay, what does this do for Sapir Whorf? Or how does this interact with the ideas put forward by Sapir Whorf? So the idea that learning another language makes more things legible to you. And it sort of, I fell into this kind of little Venn overlap area between the concept of legibility and the idea that Sapir Whorf could help you to think differently. And my take on it is actually what's happening is learning a second language is exposing to you previously illegible layers of readable information. End of thesis.
But when you say it like that, it seems pretty obvious.
It probably is. I doubt I'm the first person to have had this thought.
I guess that goes into the section of follow-up for next time. I actually have to read this article.
Do. It requires a bit of chewing on. It's not short, and it repays consideration, I feel. Your culture pick of the week?
Yeah, I tried to find a segue between these, but I didn't manage that. But well, my cultural pick of the week, of the many I already mentioned this episode, I picked the Swedish movie Tourist.
Okay.
And this movie is about, I guess, a family, a couple, spending their perhaps Easter holiday in the, I guess it was the Swiss Alps or something. Not saying too much, there is a dramatic happening and some reactions that leads to some drama.
Wow.
Every movie ever. But,
right. That's still better than about 95% of the summaries of movies on things like Netflix and iTunes.
But it highlights something about the modern male role in sort of the Nordic context. And there's also a fantastic scene with Christopher Hivju, famously known as Tormund in the Game of Thrones series. Tormund and Tormund, they are pretty similar in many ways. but yeah. So that is on my recommendation. And there's also Norwegians playing in this movie.
Cool.
The mentioned Tormund. But I think the couple also is a Norwegian and a Swedish guy.
Cool, I'll have to check it out.
Yes, word of the week. It's due.
Mine is lærepenge. And I came across this. I don't even remember the context now. I came across this and I thought, what a delightful word. It means a lesson, as in the kind you get taught. Maybe when you weren't looking to get a lesson and be taught something or learn something. But because it contains the word penge, I'm going to assume that there is value in the lesson. I tried to look up the etymology of this and I didn't get any further than it's to do with lære, which is to learn, and penge, which is money. Some people say lærepenge, I gather. But I was kind of interested in it. Like, it's clearly valuable. Like, you've learned a lesson that's clearly valuable. There is no implication in this that it was pleasurable. It can be.
No, so the implication is that it wasn't pleasurable.
Absolutely not.
At
okay.
All. Yeah.
I came across one context where I thought it could have been okay, but I guess not.
Or never say never, but mostly it's used when you did something and the consequence of it were certainly not pleasurable, but you learned something from that.
Right.
Yeah.
I'm racking my brains and completely failing to come up with like an English equivalent for this. Like one might say informally, I'd paid some kind of learning tax, I guess. But I'm at a loss for English. And I love that this phrase exists in Norwegian.
Cool.
What's yours?
Yeah. Yeah, Google translates lærepenge to lesson.
Yeah.
Which I guess misses the...
Yeah. My dictionary
subtlety.
Is the same.
Yeah. My word of the week is gressenkemann. And I wondered if there are an English term for this. But so this consists of two words, I guess, gress and enkemann. Do you know it?
No, I really don't.
So gress is grass and enkemann is a widower. And enke would be a widow, so... And it's used when your spouse has traveled for perhaps a holiday or business trip or something, and you are home alone, sort of, yeah.
Right.
So sort of a temporary widower.
Why grass?
I'm not sure. I looked up the etymology, and it's used pretty casually now, but before it was used, first you used it about a girl, gräsänka, a girl that had been sort of led astray, and as a consequence of that, been left.
Oh. Does Norwegian have a concept of the grass is always greener on the other side?
Yeah.
So is that where the grass is coming from? Is that someone has been tempted?
That seems plausible.
Interesting. Yeah, here at Small Differences, we are never afraid to sacrifice plausibility, truth, to acquire fun and plausibility, right? Yeah, we should check that. Do we have fact checkers? We should get a fact checker.
I guess we have someone on Twitter that, well, perhaps not checks the facts.
I don't know. Like, people are pretty quick
really
to
difficult
fill out
to,
the details.
To get things right on podcasts.
It's crazy when difficult.
When I listen back to it, there's so many things that I have had wrong. You have no idea. But
well, if it's anything like my experience, then yeah, I yeah. Huge sympathy there.
I'm just waiting for people to call me out on it. But they haven't. So I suspect, well, we have a host full of colleagues that claim that they listen to this podcast.
I'm not sure they do.
I'm suspicious.
Good word. Thank you.
I guess this was the episode.
I guess we're kind of done.
Where are you going on the plane?
Don't laugh. Ålesund.
Ålesund?
Yeah.
And what happens in Ålesund?
Beautiful scenery. We were there before and it was great. And we got talking about the Atlantic stretch of road. Like, this is actually near where they're digging the ship tunnel. But there's like a whole piece of road, right, that kind of runs between islands, and it's super scenic. And if the sea is rough, then it's kind of extra dramatic. And we were swithering between there and Bergen, and then I remembered that, and I mentioned it to my husband. He's like, yes, let's go there. So we're going to Ålesund for 3 days. It'll be cool. I'm looking forward to it. It's beautiful.
You should also try a sea safari.
Oh, yeah?
That is, recommended. And you may see seals.
Mm.
Which was a hard thing to say, but
she sees seals on the Atlantic seashore.
On the seashore, yeah.
Yeah.
So,
cool. They have a really good aquarium there too, with seals. Yeah. But yeah.
But you should have homework. We haven't given ourselves homework.
Hmm.
Really.
What's my homework?
Perhaps talk with some locals, Ålesunders, find a word of the week in Ålesund.
I'll try.
There's no trying.
Shopping transactions count, or the hotel transaction, I can do that.
Go to a bar at night, talk with the natives, be an anthropologist. Should we close with a new formula, perhaps?
Whoa. What do you got in mind? We should tell people where the website is.
Yeah, you do that, and I find the incantation.
Please.
Yeah.
Anything but that music. If you want to find a list of all the episodes and the show notes for today, where we will link to all the stuff that we can on the web that we've talked about with proper attribution, not just because of John Syracuse, but because it's nice to do, then you can go to smalldifferences.fireside.fm and it will all be there waiting for you, including, I hope, the updated words of the week that are probably a week or two behind. Sorry about that.
So, this one is from 1790, and how to get a girl to believe in you. You have to buy a lock from the local shop, and take some of the girl's hair and a thread from her underwear and tie this together in the lock, and then it happens.
Wow.
Magic. Can't explain that. Ha det bra. Takk for at du hørte på.
Takk for at du hørte på. Ha det bra.